This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Susie Coleman Archer. I'm Assistant Provost for Academic Affairs, and I would like to welcome you to Vanderbilt's fourth celebration of Constitution Day. As many of you know, or may not know, late in 2004, the National Congress enacted legislation that created Constitution Day. The legislation required that all educational institutions that were recipients of federal funds should provide a program on the United States Constitution on or about September 17th. Now, we got the about. We missed the 17th, but it is the 18th, and we are having a program that will deal with one aspect of the Constitution. Vanderbilt chose to make its Constitution Day celebrations educational undertakings rather than doing a red, white, and blue cake with Happy Birthday Constitution. We decided if we were going to do it, we were going to do something that was educational. Our program today deals with the executive branch of the government. We are very fortunate today to have two of Vanderbilt's leading political science professors talk to us today on the presidency. John Geer, who is Distinguished Professor of Political Science, is one of our speakers, and the other is David Lewis, a relative newcomer to Vanderbilt, who is also a professor of political science. They're going to talk to us today on the topic of if they could see it now, the evolution of the presidency from the way it was envisioned by the founding fathers to present day. So we're going to take a look over the span of time at the American presidency. So, gentlemen, it's yours.
Thanks. Well, Dave and I talked actually quite a bit about what we would do today, and one of the things that we want to stress is that this is more of a conversation than, in fact, any kind of formal lecture. We're going to try to take an unorthodox argument, and so if you have reactions during the course of it, please, just go ahead and raise your hand. You'll inevitably be having more questions about when he talks than when I do, and I understand that, but that's, we'll hopefully try to balance that in a variety of ways. First of all, what we wanted to do was something a little bit different. We just started talking about what we might think about. And the typical conventional wisdom is that if the founding fathers, if we could kind of do Jurassic Park in politics and pull out some of the DNA of Jefferson and Madison, Hamilton, Washington, and bring them back, that they would be stunned, perhaps appalled, about the size of the presidency and the operation of the presidency. They would just be taken aback by all of this. And if you take a look at the founding period and the Constitution itself, there's certainly some reasons to believe that that might be the case, and we want to try to go through that, but our broader effort is going to be to challenge that, that in point of fact, if you think of it from a certain perspective, that the founding fathers wouldn't be so surprised about what's unfolded, and in a certain odd way, they might well have expected it. And so we're going to try to push that argument, and again, please feel free to push back, because this is in the spirit of, as we said, a conversation. Well, kind of the evidence for this, and in fact, for those of you who really want that the argument in its kind of pristine form, probably would urge you to read Jeff Tulis's book, wouldn't you say? The Rhetorical Presidency. Jeff published this book 21 years ago to be precise, where he makes a big distinction between the traditional and the modern president, and that the shift to the modern president was going against the founding fathers' wishes in some fundamental ways, and in some ways that Tulis identified as quite dangerous. And so that's a serious argument, and Jeff is a serious person, somebody we both count as a friend as well. But some of the reasons why the case could be made that the presidency in its current state would stun our founding fathers. First of all, just take a look at the Constitution itself. I mean, the first branch to be discussed was, in fact, Congress. Article 1, of course. President was Article 2. If you go through Article 1, it's much longer, much, much longer than Article 2. And, in fact, it lists a lot of explicit powers, where the power is vested in the Congress. That clearly more thought was put in to Congress. There was also the general context of concern about executive power. And that concern can be discussed in lots of different ways. I mean, first of all, the revolution itself, the American Revolution, was in fact partly a reaction against tyranny, in reaction against an executive, in this case a guy named King George. They were upset about that, and so this attitude, this fear, shaped a lot of the document and a lot of the discussion, and certainly it seems to be reasonable. You know, consider, for example, and I don't know how many of you have ever read up on this, but it's actually great fun, and it's actually come out a little bit more because of the discussion of John Adams' life, both in the HBO series and, of course, in McCullough's book, that there was a huge debate over the title of the president. What were you going to refer to the president as? And in fact, Adams had this very long, tortured, pompous title that he proposed for the president. You know, His Highness, the surveyor of all he sees, or some crap like that. And people reacted very much against it, partly because they thought Adams himself was pompous. But more importantly, they did not want to make the president anything like a king. And Washington himself was very, very sensitive to this fact. He did not want any fancy titles, and in fact, of course, it was settled to be Mr. President, and that was partly because what Washington wanted. And if you take a look at how Washington approached the presidency, it was with caution and care every time to make sure that he did not show any real ambition to hold power. He refused to go to New York to the swearing-in ceremony, start moving that way until it was all official. He knew he was going to be the president, but it hadn't yet been, you know, officially counted the votes, because it took a while to get a quorum going in Congress so the vote, the Electoral College votes could be counted. You know, the presidential elections were supposed to be March 4th, and all the votes were counted by then, but in point of fact, he didn't take office till the end of April because things were slow, and he was slow to react because he did not want to seem anxious. So you take that whole time. And in fact, the whole position of the presidency, even though it wasn't, you know, discussed in great detail in the document, and the Founding Fathers certainly discussed a lot, but it was with Washington in mind. I mean, if in fact Washington was not going to be the first president, that might have had a document that was even more constrained, because people had faith that Washington would in fact be above politics and would not undertake the actions that would lead to kind of a tyrannical rule. So again, you know, whatever we did get out of the presidency in regards to the Constitution is a testimony to people's faith in Washington. Without that, it would have been a problem. So if you take all this time, there's good reasons to believe that now, if you, you know, pluck these individuals back from time and brought them to witness what's going on now in Washington, in particular in the presidency and the White House, they would, in fact, be stunned. So that's kind of the argument that would be laid out. And so now I'm going to turn over to my trusty friend and colleague to move forward. And we're going to just go back and forth on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's fair to say that when I teach the presidency, I try to impress on the students that Article 1 is Article 1 for a reason, that there is this sense in which Congress is the first branch. It's not only the protector of the people's rights against tyrannical executives, but it's the lawmaking branch, the public policy deciding branch. And so there's plenty of evidence to be found in the founding period that there was this notion that at least in terms of a balance and separation of powers, the Congress is supposed to be preeminent. And we want to be clear here. We do think that there have been tremendous changes in the presidency. It's not, I think it would be inane to argue that the presidency hasn't changed dramatically from 1789. So it's grown in size, right? So where the presidency was one person originally, where George Washington had to pay from his own salary for staff to do the work of the presidency, to an institution where several thousand people work in the White House complex, in the old executive office building, the new executive office building. This staff comprises, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 people in 12 different government agencies. These people see it as their job to serve the president, not to serve Congress. The institution of the presidency continues from administration to administration. New presidents come in, and a staff of the presidency continues. It doesn't all turn over from one administration to another. And so the presidency itself as an institution is dramatically different and has undergone significant changes. And John and I certainly recognize that. What's also true is that the position of the federal executive has changed in American politics, so that the president now, arguably, whereas previously this was not true, is the center of the political universe. I think that when the economy has difficulties, when some major social problem goes unaddressed, it's the president that's held accountable for these things, fairly or unfairly. And I think we'd probably argue unfairly, the president is held accountable in the American political system for the performance of the whole government. And that certainly was not true before, but it's certainly true today. And what's also true is that culturally the American president has a tremendous place. We're sort of fixated. How many of you know what Bill Clinton's cat's name was?
Socks.
There you go. We know the name of Nixon's dog, right? Checkers. We know what vegetables George H.W. Bush doesn't like, right? Remember, he doesn't eat broccoli. He said that when he got into the office, he'd eaten broccoli his whole life, and now that he was president, he decided that the time had ended for him to eat broccoli.
And he settled on pork rinds instead. Not exactly good for the American health.
So the presidency has changed. It's grown in size and stature and importance, both politically and culturally, and the president's role as a legislative leader is now well-established where it wasn't established before. That's not to say that the president was not involved, as we'll get into, but it's well-established. And so we want to make sure that the argument we're making is not one that says the president's the same as it was before or that there's no evidence that the founders would be somewhat surprised. We want to just sort of counter that argument.
Yeah, and it's based partly on a belief, and we'll return to this in the conclusion as well, that the founding fathers were just very keen observers of politics and highly skilled politicians. They were not ideologues or anything along that line, and that they would be able to react to whatever conditions that they were presented, and so that they would create a different set of rules if, in fact, they were confronted with a different context. And so that we need to understand that context that they envisioned at the start, and then part of our argument is that there's a new context, and therefore they would not be surprised because you'd want a document and a government to reflect those new conditions. And so the document is flexible, and the conditions have changed, and therefore so is the power of the president. Well, why aren't we surprised, or at least why we don't think the founding fathers would be surprised? First of all, one of the things we want to raise, and again, it's not a particularly major point, but just put it out on the table, is that the idea that there is the founding opinion, the founder's opinion, that there's one single opinion out there is obviously false. The founding fathers were an eclectic group. They obviously had major disagreements. There were huge numbers of compromises at the Constitutional Convention. And if you can just imagine the role of the federal government, compare Hamilton's view to Jefferson's view, for example, and how that view then played out over the coming years once the Constitution was adopted, indicates that, in fact, there was lots of disagreement about executive power. But think about some of the changes that have taken place in this country, and then it begins to move us towards the argument that we want to make. First of all, Jefferson, of course, envisioned an agricultural nation. I mean, that was part and parcel of why he got the Louisiana Purchase through. He envisioned a nation of farmers. And, in fact, at the time of the founding, approximately 90% of the country were farmers. And, of course, now today, that percentage is about 3%. I mean, just a massive change. And we've had this industrial revolution, and the country has obviously undergone that massive change. We've become a world power. And with the time, we were going to be an isolated agrarian power. In fact, isolationism is still a thread that plays throughout American politics today. And it was very strong at that point, and there was no ambition, at least not very well seen, that this was going to be a world power. That was England, that was France's role. It was not going to be the U.S.'s, and so you didn't necessarily need a strong executive because you weren't going to be playing that kind of a role. Also, remember that at the time of the founding, think about the typical citizen and the access that typical citizen had to information. First of all, only about 10% of the country was literate, and now it's 95% or higher, depending on how you want to measure it. The spread of information is just dramatic. Back then, it took a long period of time for information to travel. I'm still staggered by the fact that in 1865, you know, 411 years later, whatever the, more like, I guess, 9 years after the founding, you had parts of the country that took 4 to 5 days before they found out about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Andrew Jackson's famous battle in New Orleans was fought after, technically, the War of 1812 had come to an end. We just didn't know about it. And now information is there. So imagine the founding fathers realizing that the public's literate, the public's informed, and they can get information. Back then, it was very hard to get information, or at least harder. And so, again, that kind of context would change. The sheer growth of the country, 3 million to 300 million. And, of course, the simple size of the country. Again, you know, how many people envisioned that we would just have the East Coast? We were talking with Bruce Oppenheimer, our colleague, yesterday about some of the ideas, and we were mentioning about Jefferson and the Louisiana Purchase, and he pointed out, and I'd forgotten about this, that Jefferson envisioned it would take 30 generations to populate the land that they just secured through the Louisiana Purchase. He was wrong. It turned out only 3 generations. I mean, huge numbers of changes. So when you think about that and you bring back, and the Founding Fathers would be aware of those changes, we could easily see they might be willing to go along with it or not be surprised. Well, let's take a look at the document itself and try to play that out. That is, can we see hints of this argument playing out within the Constitution itself? Well, first of all, Article 2 just vests, you know, the executive power in the president is very open-ended and vague. Now, one can interpret that as a glass half full or half empty, but obviously for the purposes of argument, we want to view it as half full. Also, of course, recall that the Constitution was being written as a response to the failures of the Articles of Confederation, to the failures of the fact that you did not have any kind of executive in the Articles of Confederation and that you needed some sort of one. And that was one of the clear lessons that were taken away from the period of the Articles. And then finally, that the Founding Fathers would, I think, fully appreciate the role of presidential elections and popularity and power. That is, that when they put the presidency into place, they had the idea of the Electoral College, which was basically going to be each state getting together, having a meeting of various officials and deciding who was going to be the best president. I mean, they were in some ways naive about this in that many of them didn't anticipate the rise of parties. But the presidency now is an institution that is elected through popular vote. Obviously, the Electoral College still plays a role, and I'm sure we could get a different view from Al Gore exactly how it works. But the point is that their attention had to shift to the public. And so, therefore, when they began to derive power from the public and pay more attention, that was going to legitimize their office more and potentially give them more power. And you could easily imagine the Founding Fathers understanding that dynamic. And so that they understood the importance of selection. I mean, remember that the Founding Fathers chose not to have Congress select the president. There was some discussion about that. But if, in fact, you'd had Congress select the president, well, then you would have had really a one institution dominating the government. Then it would have been Congress. But they chose not to. They chose to separate power, and they chose to separate the selection. There was some sentiment for that, but overwhelmingly they didn't do it. And they really didn't trust the people either. And the reason they didn't trust the people is because they didn't think the public had enough information. They weren't very educated, weren't very informed. In fact, one founding father is quoted as saying, allowing the public to choose the president would be the same as allowing a blind man to choose colors. They just had no faith there. They didn't have faith in Congress, and they steered this middle course, which has certainly had lots of implications. So if you go through and look at the documents, you can begin to see that the Founding Fathers understood that executive power mattered, and they could also imagine executive power accumulating as well. I mean, they understood the role of power. So I'm not going to turn it over to...
Yeah, I mean, I just would build on that a little bit to say that there is this... Joseph Ellis, a historian, makes this argument that there are really two foundings, right? There's sort of the founding moment in 1776, which is something like a reaction against executive power. And then there's a second founding in 1789, which is a reaction against having no executive power. And that the document itself, in some ways, is created at a historical moment where the need for a strong executive and an energetic executive is well understood. And so there's at least an argument to be made that the lack of clarity in Article 2, in certain provisions in Article 2, is a nod toward this idea that, hey, maybe a stronger executive is something that we need. So the document doesn't delineate the formal powers of the president in the way that it does for Congress. It doesn't say the power is herein granted, or sort of vested in a president. It says the executive power is vested in a president of the United States. We don't know what the executive power is. There's not very much clarity about that. And the document itself was sort of vague. And I think that part of John and I's argument is that it's this vagueness precisely which gets worked out over time. And it gets worked out in a political fashion through the interaction of the three branches in a way that I think that these founders as politicians would understand, that conditional on the changes in society that they could not have anticipated, they would not be surprised now at the distribution of power in the national government. So let me say a little bit more about that. I think the first evidence we have that this is the case is that you could look at early practice. So John gave you some examples in the document about how it speaks to a stronger executive, but early practice, I think, also does as well. That's not to say that the early practice is reflective of what's happening today, but at least that there are hints in the document of what practice was to come, particularly with certain changes in the political environment. So the president was involved in the legislature early on, creating plans for the Treasury. The president was involved early on in the day-to-day management of the executive branch. There's this notion that somehow the Treasury itself was going to be an instrument of Congress, and certainly they debated that. There was some notion that Congress itself was the rightful governor of the executive branch. But when you look at the history, the administrative history of people like Leonard White, it becomes clear that the early presidents, somewhat spottily, but certainly George Washington, was actively involved in running the day-to-day affairs of the national government. You could even argue to some extent that they were taking into account things like political loyalty in staffing the administration, that they were involved in what we might call today politicizing the government. So it's true that Washington selected the early people of the administration on the basis of what he considered to be competence. That meant selecting gentlemen of certain sort of birth or qualifications or professional reputation, but he also selected people who only supported the Constitution, which was arguably the most important political cleavage of the day. Presidents were engaged in foreign affairs in an active way, in committing troops without consultation of Congress. They were involved in running spy networks and keeping secrets from Congress. They were issuing proclamations about what foreign policy would be in ways that would put the U.S. In danger of going to war. They were involved in armed conflicts in ways that weren't approved by Congress. So these things are not, at this point, as well established as they would become later on through practice, but there were at least hints of what was to come. And I guess my point in saying those things, and I think our view is that that the Constitution itself and the way that it talks about the presidency is something like DNA. That there are certain aspects of your DNA that are readily apparent, right? So your hair color or your eye color or certain physical characteristics are readily apparent. And there are some things in the Constitution that are analogous to that. We know that that you have to be 35 years of age to be eligible for the presidency. You have to be a natural-born citizen. Okay, well, those things are relatively clear. The Constitution basically predicts kind of what the political landscape is going to look like. But other aspects of your genetic code don't have that character to them. They only manifest themselves over time. So because John is here, I'm going to say things like height, or you might say male pattern baldness. These are characteristics that are embedded in your DNA that will only manifest themselves over time through practice.
Let's back up.
Similarly, I would argue, and I think John would argue as well, that there are certain aspects of the constitutional design that, even if they were not apparent at the beginning, were bound to emerge because of the way the system was set up. So things like the vesting clause and the take care clause are going to have particular meanings because of the way the institutions are set up to struggle with each other. The last thing I'll say about the DNA analogy is just this, that there are also certain aspects of the Constitution that are physical proclivities. That is, things like physical strength. Some people by DNA are going to be physically stronger than others, but it only matters if the person chooses to use them. And there are certain parts of the Constitution that are like that as well. They're sort of tools that are waiting to be picked up and used, and the choices of individual presidents will determine whether those things become powerful or not. And what I want to argue, and I think John wants to argue as well, is that the fundamentals of this constitutional DNA are understood. That the founders, as very practical, experienced politicians, understand the system that they set up. They understood how the power dynamics would work. They didn't understand how the nation would change. But conditional on knowing that, I think they could predict with some accuracy what the distribution of power would look like and what the presidency would look like. And this is why they took auxiliary precautions in the document itself to prevent executive tyranny through the creation of auxiliary precautions, like separation of powers, checks and balances. You might even argue that elections and federalism are means of preventing executive tyranny. So I'll just sort of stop there and let John say a little bit about their understanding of what an expanded selectorate would look like. We went from a system where there was a handful of people that selected the president to one where millions of people are selecting the president.
Yeah, and that was good. You know, that fundamental shift. I mean, if you go back in your history books, and students are always stunned by this, but you know, just as a small reminder, most of you are already aware of it. If you go back in the history books, there was no popular vote. If you ask what percentage of the vote did George Washington get, people, what did he get? well, they didn't count the votes. There wasn't really vote count until 1824, because slowly but surely it wasn't the state legislature that was choosing the members of the Electoral College, but the public started to do that. And then with the rise of Jacksonian democracy, pretty much every state did it by 1828 and certainly by 1832. I think there was only two or three states that were lagging behind, so to speak. But that was going to change dramatically the power base of the president, because they could then reach out to the public. They'd need to pay attention to the public before they'd want to pay attention to the state legislature. Just think about what happened with the Senate when it went from being selected by the state legislature to the public. It's going to change where you're going to pay attention. It's going to change your base of power, and it's going to lead to all kinds of changes. And I think one way to try to get a handle on the differences between and the ability of these presidents, or these individuals, the founding fathers, to anticipate this, is think about the struggle between Jefferson and Hamilton. Jefferson really wanted an agricultural society, and that's why he did, as I said earlier, go through with the Louisiana Purchase, was going to create this farmer nation of farmers that was going to allow it to be decentralized. You weren't going to need a strong executive. But compare, as David was saying, the DNA argument, look at Hamilton's notion. Hamilton's idea was much more industrial-based. He would be less surprised in general about what's unfolded in this country than Jefferson, I think. And he wanted a different kind of executive because he envisioned a different role for the country. They both anticipated different settings for the country, and they played it out differently. And so, again, this gets back, A, to the notion that there isn't a simple founder's intent, but it also plays to the fact that they were aware of the different contexts, and they had battles over it. Because Jefferson knew that if Hamilton's vision won out, it was going to lead to a different distribution of power. It was going to lead to potentially tyranny. It was going to lead to a stronger executive. These are the things that they kind of worried and battled about.
I mean, underneath this also is this institutional setup that advantages some actors and disadvantages others. That is, there's something like a deck stacking that occurs when the Constitution is created. And what's striking about the Constitution when you read it now is if you compare just the text of the Constitution to something like any modern statute, it's significantly shorter and much less detailed. And I think that the founders knew that the interpretation of the meaning of the Constitution would be something that would be worked out between the political branches through political interactions. When I teach American politics and I talk about the bureaucracy, I say, look, what does the Constitution say about the bureaucracy? It says almost nothing. It neither describes nor empowers a bureaucracy in a famous phrase. And so what that means is that the bureaucracy, as it's created, is created by politicians making political choices. And I think that the founders understood this. They also understood the system they'd set up in terms of separation of powers. They thought that they had done an admirable job in terms of setting up auxiliary precautions to prevent one branch from dominating the other. But given the changes in the environment that advantage certain actors, I think they wouldn't be surprised about these changes. So let me say a little bit about some of these examples. So what I would argue is that presidents have a constitutional advantage in their ability to act unitarily. That is, to take actions and force Congress to respond or force the courts to respond. And that's a huge advantage in a political system where it's difficult for the other branches to respond quickly, to respond in a unified fashion. So in areas where the Constitution is unclear, presidents act. They make an interpretation. They start doing things. And then they force the other branches to respond. And do those other branches respond? Sometimes they do, but generally they don't. And why don't they? Well, why doesn't Congress respond? Why don't they restrain the president when they start issuing signing statements, when they start interpreting the veto in a different way than perhaps some had expected, when they start using the removal power, when they start issuing executive orders with policy content or using executive agreements instead of treaties? The simple answer is that they're not set up to respond very effectively, right? They're trapped in a collective action problem, right? Anytime the president does something, what's Congress's response? Congress's response is to try to pass new legislation to overturn the president's interpretation. All right, so if the president takes a statute that Congress has passed, they interpret it in a particular way, they start doing things, Congress could pass a new law to respond to that. It's got to get out of a committee. It's got to get through committee chairs. It's got to get through the House. It's got to get through the Senate. It probably has to get through an appropriations committee and an authorization committee. It has to get through a Senate filibuster, which means it requires at least a three-fifths majority, and before that, a larger majority, and then the president can veto it. All right, so what position does that put Congress in their ability to constrain presidents in a wide range of presidential activities or interpretations of the law? What about the courts? Well, the courts are in a difficult position, right, because they're not going out searching for things that presidents have done wrong. They have to wait for cases to be brought, right? They have to wait for people with specific harms that have a charge that can be remedied, that's justiciable, that's ripe, that's not that's something that the court can provide a remedy for. And courts don't go out looking for things. They have to be brought to them. And in many of these interbranch disputes, those things don't exist. And what's worse for courts is, one, presidents nominate judges, right, so they can point pro-executive judges. And two, presidents have a history of ignoring court decisions, right? At least up to the modern period, this was a real threat for the courts. So on an individual level, individual members of Congress, they all benefit when the institution is strong relative to the president. But few of them have an incentive to actually pay the cost of taking the president on, building coalitions and stopping presidents when they try to expand their power. It's a typical collective action problem. And what makes it even harder for them is that there are cross-cutting pressures of the type that John described of parties, right? So I may prefer a stronger Congress in general, but if the president is using expanded constitutional power to do something that I like, I'm not going to go against the president on principle because the president's from my party and I like what they're doing. And as a consequence, presidents have been able to aggrandize power. And I think that's not a surprise to the founders. The founders wouldn't be surprised that presidents would try to aggrandize their power. That's not to say that Congress never stops presidents or that courts never stop presidents. I would say it's rare, and that the prime mover in these constitutional debates and interpretations has been the president. It's been the president, and Congress has been a willing partner, either to acquiesce or even in some cases to expand the president's power. Presidents were given the power over budgets by Congress. They were given the power over the economy by Congress. They were the institutional presidency was built up by laws passed by Congress. And why is that? It's because the changes in American government that John described, the growth in the volume, scope, and complexity of what government does, the involvement of the U.S. in world affairs, makes it extremely difficult for Congress to restrain presidents and to handle those things on their own. And because their incentives work that way, they don't play the role in checking the president the way that that they might. But I think the founders would have understood that. They're the ones that set up the system that established the constitutional DNA.
Yeah, so what, as kind of a concluding, I'll paint a few strokes and include and then take any kind of questions that people have. And we just want to stress again, both David and I, that you know, the founding fathers were fundamentally politicians. I mean, I signed one of Ellis's books. In fact, I actually started signing Gordon Wood's most recent book to my introductory classes because there's a tendency for people to think that the founding fathers were really above politics. And that's just, I don't think, even close to the truth. They were mired in it. And look at some of the compromises that they chose to make, whether it be like the Three-Fifths Compromise or others. It was sheer political calculation on their part. And that's why they undertook some of those things. So they are, in fact, politicians. And as politicians, they would react. I mean, there's a lot of belief that people say, oh, well, if you took these individuals out and you put them in the modern era, they couldn't possibly function. Our point is, in some sense, that's false. That, in fact, political skill is something that cuts across a lot of generations. And, yes, it's being played out on a different stage. And people say, oh, the rise of television has changed things dramatically. And that couldn't possibly allow politicians of one era to do well in another's. Well, it highlights different skills. Certainly does, and there's no doubt that being good on TV helps a lot. But think about other changes in politics. Think about the rise of the microphone. The rise of the microphone is hugely important in politics because you could all of a sudden reach a large crowd without necessarily having a deep, booming voice. Lots of little kind of technological changes have mattered, but I think core political skills will cut across all of that. And the founding fathers would take a look at a nation that's a world power, that's in an environment where things have to be decided in a split second, especially in regards to military matters, they would inevitably, at least if we believe, inevitably want a stronger chief executive because it's the only way to operate in this environment. You couldn't let Congress run the show, but you could let Congress run the show if you had Jefferson's agricultural kind of base of a society. And also, one final thing, that when we think about the presidency, and we're trying to say the founding fathers aren't wouldn't be shocked, is it probably pays for us to try to distance ourselves a little bit from the current president and the current things that have unfolded, because inevitably partisanship intervenes in our judgments. And if somebody's not, let's say, a strong Democrat, they may be particularly upset with some of the things that the Bush administration has done, and it's too powerful, it goes against what the founding fathers wanted, et cetera. That probably needs to sort that out, put that aside. I mean, yes, I think Bush is gathered power for the presidency, but it was also in reaction to an event, 9/11. I think a Democratic president would have done some of the same things, certainly not all of them. But we want to disentangle that. Not because we don't believe partisan politics matters, but we don't want to have, you know, these kinds of arguments being tainted by whether you're a fan of President Bush or of not. But at the end, that these were highly skilled individuals. That it's quite remarkable that they were all able to get together in one room and put together a document that has at least withstood the test of time in some important ways. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, other than I would say that presidential scholars were big fans of the imperial presidency until it turned away from the Democratic Party, and then they were sanguine about it.
Yeah, it's great fun to, when Johnson was doing all this, that was okay. But with Bush doing it, it's a little less. And I have to say, I subscribe to that argument a little bit, but I'm just showing my own partisan stripes, so we got to put those aside and try to rise above it a little bit. So, any thoughts on Constitution Day? And we're saying we're so clear that you all believe it immediately. Rob?
Question for both of you. I guess you use this metaphor, this analogy to DNA. And you seem to say that the framers sort of had it all worked out, and sort of the brilliance of their plan is only now becoming clear to us, much like male pattern baldness, which I have as well.
And it is brilliant, too.
I'm trying. I have a bunch of older brothers, so I can see sort of where I'm but sort of the idea is that, the framers had it all worked out, and the brilliance of their plan is only now coming to light. I'm wondering if that's the correct use of DNA, or maybe there's a different story you could tell, which is that there was a creature that the framers constructed that had a certain DNA, and that creature died, and it had offspring. And that offspring, had partial DNA from the framers, but also, new generations, the time of the Civil War, time of the New Deal, multiple times in between. And so the creature we have now, it's not that, that early DNA is only now coming to light. It's that, it's been infused with DNA, and right now it's only, 1/16th or 1/32nd, or whatever you might say, the vision of the framers. And then, in fact, you could say that the framers wouldn't be terribly surprised today, or you might just say that they would be shocked. It's really just over time that new ideas have been sort of infused in the Constitution, and that's why the Constitution works today. It's that it's not the same creature; it's the 8th or 10th or 20th generation, however you want to count.
I guess my view, Rob, is that it's that a better analogy would be that that the sort of the DNA that exists. But the environment in which the DNA has been dropped into has changed, and that the DNA maybe changes a little bit in response to environmental changes, but it's not that you've sort of adopted some new constitution on top of it that changes the fundamentals of it. It's rather there are some adaptations that become activated or become realized because of the environment, although I hesitate to use natural science analogies as if they have some magical power to explain things, but I just thought that was...
I mean, the way following up on Dave's point is, I actually had fun last spring teaching with a guy in the med school, a really good friend of mine, Dave Bader, course on genetics and politics, which really got some of the kids quite fired up because, I keep telling them not only they're going to start thinking like their parents, but they're going to start looking like them, or brothers or sisters. And in my case, I find that deeply troubling. But and so does my father. But nonetheless.
And your children.
My son's very upset about his future. I think he touches his hair every morning and counts the strands, but it's going down. But the kind of the fundamental equation that we took from the natural sciences is you want to explain some outcome, whether it be the Constitution or political behavior, whatever. is that there's some force of nature and then there's some force of the environment. And then there's the interaction between the two, which was Dave's idea of that you may be genetically determined to be quite strong, but unless you decide to take an active lifestyle, work out, or do whatever, that particular trait will never be developed unless you act on it. And it's that interaction that's really where the action is. Now, having said that, that's why this argument was fun. I can see easily the twist in the analogy and the way that you're framing it. And I'm not so sure there's all that much difference to it. But because if you think about, think of it in statistical terms, and you think of the coefficients of each of those three parameters, that the interaction is where, a lot of the action's going to be. And in fact, even geneticists will argue that today when you're thinking about behavior, that it isn't, we're not just a product of our DNA, and certainly the environment matters, but it's that interaction. Trying to figure that out, is really, really tough stuff. It's an interesting take on it. Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Well, I kind of think of it, having studied the Constitution and all, from the original writing, there was a lot of arguments and they had a lot of meetings and, it almost never took place. I mean, if you study, because it took a really long time. And so I kind of think of it from a science point of view that there was a virus, because immediately after signing the original Constitution, they went back and started writing Bill of Rights, because they already foresee that there was a problem and that there was going to be a misinterpretation already in the original Constitution.
Well, I'd be interested in Dave's take on it. I think first of all, they put the, I'm not an expert on the founding period, but the Bill of Rights was put in place largely to placate the attack, or to ease the attacks from the anti-federalists. I mean, they were vicious, they were strong. We talk about negative campaigning, go back to that period, and then all of a sudden the stuff that's going on between McCain and Obama's child's play. Serious stakes, because we're not talking about who wins the presidency, we're talking about the rules of the game. I mean, huge, important stakes. And so part of the mechanism, part of the reasoning for the Bill of Rights was that it made it easier to pass. It was to get New York's, for example, to go along with it. So that, again, I would interpret the Bill of Rights as a political reaction rather than them immediately going away from it. But I don't know if you...
Yeah, the only thing, I think that's an interesting analogy. I think I would say that there were, again, on this idea that there were multiple founding opinions, I think that there were some that felt like the Bill of Rights was unnecessary, that it was sort of redundant, that the provision of the Constitution itself and the powers that the states and the limited powers that the national government have would make those additional Bill of Rights unnecessary, that the rights would be protected in the document itself. But they went along with it as a political compromise. But obviously there was disagreement about that.
Yeah, and there were some guys that did not sign it. And, of course, one state that wasn't represented at the time of signing. So, obviously, it wasn't a unanimous decision. Yeah.
No, that's right. I mean, there wasn't the founder's intent, which is, you're absolutely right about that. Yes, sir.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, thanks to both of you for joining us in this and for this debate and presenting this. I find it very fascinating. Two things. One is quick, and it may just be a throwaway, but I think it's told up quickly. You said split second military decision. Did you really mean that we make military decisions in split seconds now? Yeah.
Well,
it strikes me as,
basically my point is that as a world power in the kind of technological environment we have, we need to have some actor, whether it be a president or Congress or whatever that actor is, be able to respond quickly to threats. And that your first action is not to call a committee meeting. And so a split second is obviously an exaggeration. But, if you think of what happened in 9/11, there were, very swift actions. And Congress, in fact, unified. And maybe, in fact, they could do it if, in fact, there was a sufficient threat. But it was more that in an effort to protect the country, to be able to react quickly, you need the unitary actors. Just my argument. I'm not even sure if Dave subscribes to that notion.
Yeah, I just sort of read it as an exaggeration. Obviously, in cases where a threat is identified that requires an immediate response, somebody has to respond to it relatively quickly. And John's argument is simply that in the modern era, there are more of those things. They happen more quickly, and it demands more centralized authority to respond to it with secrecy, dispatch, and I forget the phrase that the founders used, but something of that nature.
Okay, I understand, but here's where I want to press it. Just a little bit of this. States of Maine, even in those instances, a president is going to call a particular cabinet committee. Let's call it the National Security Council.
Right.
He's going to, that is a, so I wouldn't want to endorse a notion that we've got to empower the presidents until the point where that can be an action taken by a single individual. We wouldn't even call that group together.
Right. No.
To advise her or him about something.
No, I agree. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I don't want. I was making more just trying to compare that. On average, the executive will react quicker than Congress. But I could envision a scenario where Congress would set up a set of rules where they would, and so you could easily. So you create a prime minister's office, right? You know that's all. But that would then go against their idea of having the three branches checking each other.
The law of Mississippi, for both you and David, whatever the limitation may be of the DNA model, what is striking to me is the use of a particular kind of reasoning that was exemplified even more today by talking about the course you taught with a colleague from the medical center and talking about DNA on one side and five on the other and the interaction between the two and using things like the coefficients. Now, you see, that kind of reasoning is very different from talking about, from thinking that what kind of guidance would come out of the Constitution is already there in something of like original intent. And all we got to do is go get it, and we can read it back onto the present situation. Go and see that the way in which you all approach this in terms of thinking doesn't come down on the side of something called original intent as being the authoritative source of what we're supposed to do today. Is that a fair extension for what you were saying?
I think that's probably fair. The difficulty, or you know, part of the analogy with the DNA was to say there are probably some aspects of the Constitution that are clear enough to give clear guidance about what things ought to look like, but there are many provisions in the Constitution where the plain language of the Constitution doesn't provide enough guidance to determine what the meaning is. And so then the question is, given that that's the case, where do you go to find out what the meaning of those words is? And the argument that John and I would make is that the founders recognized that some of these details would have to be worked out in practice, that while the document, they tried to be as clear as they could in the document, the need for compromise, the need to sort of end the convention, et cetera, left certain things not worked out, and they were going to have to be worked out in a political process that was shaped by the Constitution itself, that set certain incentives, certain feelings, motivations, and interactions in place that would shape what the meaning of those unclear provisions were. So yes, we're moving away from original intent or clear intent. I just think it's hard to defend the notion that all of these provisions of the Constitution are clear enough to give clear guidance. I mean, if you want to go to original intent, what you would probably have to do is, as Jack Rakoff says, go back to the state ratifying conventions and figure out what the states themselves thought they were ratifying, because that's what empowers the Constitution. Not the document itself, but the decisions of the individual states. And then what complications do you face if the states themselves disagree about what it is that they're ratifying or what the meaning of the Constitution is? And so it's difficult, and you know, the further you get away from the document, to figure out what the intent was.
Yeah. I'd just say I think they were intentionally vague. I mean, some of the intent was not to provide any, you know, clarity, because they weren't sure. And of course, on some things they couldn't come to agreement, and so they just dodged it. You had a hand up earlier. Is that?
I've got a serious question. That's okay. Now I'm just thinking about something.
Okay.
Going back to the concept of the separation of powers, it seems like a good concept. But given your enumeration of the difficulties, for instance, in Congress, the number of steps that would have to be taken to enact legislation to counter something that the president had done, and the Supreme Court's kind of standoff position, let it come to me before I do anything about it. Does that concept really work, the concept of separation of powers, to the checks and balances so that no one gets too much out of touch with the others, that it could cause harm? In your estimation, does it really work?
You want to deal with that one? Let me take a stab at it.
That's a hard one. I do think that there are demonstrated and persistent difficulties in the ability of the other branches to restrain the president, particularly in areas where they have such a huge advantage in information like security and so forth. So I am concerned about the ability of the other branches to restrain presidents. But I also, my hope is that there are other means by which the powers of the president would be restrained, either through the choice of individual presidents or through the attentiveness of active and involved publics, which encounters many of the same problems that Congress has.
Yeah, it is a tough question. One thing that I'd, again, it's just a reminder to folks is that, you know, we have a system of separation of powers, but it's also a system of shared powers. And so that, and it's still, you know, shared. And you go through periods where the president, right now, the president has accumulated more power than, let's say, 10 years ago. And I suspect that will, you know, the Congress will reassert itself and chip away at that. What I get worried about is while there's these cycles, it seems like it's on an upward trend. And so that the president has, in fact, accrued, you know, a lot more power in a lot of different ways. But, you know, the system is flexible and it seems to, you know, to work. But, you know, it's again an example of how hard it is to make these judgments, separate them out from partisanship. Because, again, you know, partisans are going to take very different slices of this, different cuts at it, and there isn't a single answer to it, which is, my answer is not satisfactory, I know.
Let me jump back in here. I mean, I think that there are several ways that the Constitution and the setup of the nation intended to limit executive power. The primary means, of course, was having elections so that the public could restrain presidents that were behaving poorly. There's federalism, right? You divide powers between the national government and the state and local governments. There's separation of powers, that is, you sort of have separate institutions sharing power so they can check each other. And then you have the Bill of Rights. And while some of these things have worked less well than others, and I would argue, for example, that federalism has sort of been less successful at restraining national government power or presidential power than we might have expected, and we might have concerns about separation of power, I would actually argue that in the modern period, courts are more powerful now than they were in earlier periods. That is, there's a politics surrounding the courts now which makes it much more difficult for presidents to disobey court decisions than they did in previous eras. And so while separation of powers might not work as well, things like the Bill of Rights, separation of powers in terms of Congress, but the Bill of Rights might be more active and the ability of the courts to restrain presidents might be better now than in the past.
Let's take one more question before we have to go, or maybe two.
Okay. Yeah, we'll take both.
We were talking, so with part of the extension of executive power, it seemed to stem out of collective action concerns with specific issues that you want to get it to a person who's able to do it more quickly. But when the Constitution was created by a group of individuals from different states, they were working on a collective action basis. And in instilling with the Congress specific duties, they decided to put some of those duties into this collective action problem that they've already seen what kind of issues come up and how it can slow down. So how can we go from a point where they are accepting and experiencing collective action to saying that eventually they'd say, it's okay, we have to get rid of this and just install a Speaker of the House to make this decision for us, instead of compromising on 3/5, let's just pick somebody to choose the right one so we can move on and go forward.
So I'm not sure I understand the
okay, like,
question.
For instance, with the collective act, okay, so when they came together and they instilled on the Congress has the right or the responsibility to declare war. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the issues we've been talking about most recently, where you need a quick response.
Right.
Why did Congress put it into a collective action area with an express duty onto the Congress if they wanted an executive branch that had superpowers?
Well, I would say probably two things. One is that they did not anticipate the speed with which these decisions would have to be made in a different kind of world that we live in today. So they didn't anticipate that. That would be one answer. And the other thing is that They may have anticipated different types of decision-making processes even then, that while it's the Congress's power to declare war, clearly within a few years of the Constitution being enacted, there are certain people believing that it's okay to respond to military actions abroad without congressional approval. So arguably, maybe there was some understanding even then that executives could take unilateral action without congressional approval. And so it wasn't really dumped in Congress's lap to make those kinds of quick decisions.
Yeah, and it also plays off the idea that the, you know, when the Constitution was being written, it was also playing off, as Ellis said, reaction against having a weak or no chief executive, and so they wanted to have one. And you know, when you think about, we were talking about this yesterday as we were trying to game this out, so to speak, that Washington was really was under pressure to run for a third term, and he chose not to run for a third term because of his health, and he wanted to go back home. But if he had run for a third term, he would have created the precedent of a president, once they get into office, they don't leave until they die. And would have been a very different precedent than, in fact, the two-term limit that was a norm until Roosevelt broke it. And it was such a strong norm that they then institutionalized it through an amendment. And so that, you know, some of these early, you know, you think of these early times, these, again, getting back to our general theme, these were skilled politicians trying to feel their way to a new system that they thought would work better. But they, they didn't have all the answers. They knew they didn't have all the answers. And so they were trying to feel around. So you can pick and choose and find different ways, and you can interpret it, you know, looking at it differently. And I don't even have a problem with those arguments or the other ones. It's what makes it so fun. And trying to figure out people's intent is a nightmare. It's why economists and Freudians have it all over us. It's sex or it's money, and that's it, and they're done. It's a boring field, in my opinion. But, you know, we're doing much more interesting things because it's mixed motives. It's sex and money for us. If you do, I always tease because my colleague Bruce Oppenheimer takes the Senate seriously, and so therefore I don't. And I tease him that, you know, if we do away with the Electoral College, we might as well do away with the Senate, because part of the argument for doing away with the college is that you're really biasing the small states. And of course, the fact that Wyoming gets, you know, two senators, same as California, or you have three electoral votes versus California's 56, I think it is now, you know, proportionally based on per person representation, it would be a problem. I think that, I mean, the fairness argument, one person, one vote, it's easy to do away with the college. The one thing that I would worry about doing away with the college is how would it change campaigning? Right now, we have a problem with the college because we have, political science has collected pretty good data. The people who live in the 18 battleground states are more informed about the campaign than the people who aren't. Hardly a surprising finding, but it's one that has small d Democratic implications, because folks in Alabama aren't necessarily as well-informed as those in Ohio, and that shouldn't be taking place. But if you did away with the college, where would people campaign? They would have new battlegrounds. And so what would play out? And the representational relationship between the public and the president would change. And I'm not sure that's a bad thing, but it's something that people have not thought about. And the real problem of 2000 was that all the attention was put on Florida and the ballot, and the Electoral College was left to the side. And there was no discussion. And by the time we settled that presidential election, and the, what was it, 7 weeks? That's not quite right. 6 weeks, whatever it was. People were just worn out. There was no, you know, there was no interest in discussing the college. And that's too bad, because we did need to have, frankly, in my opinion, a national conversation about it. Not because I think it should be eliminated. I have some sympathies for it. But at the same time, we need to think through carefully. You know, we've talked in some sense about incentives. Well, if you change the incentives of those who want to be president, what's that? How's that going to play out? Maybe the worthwhile thing to do, but we need to be very careful.
Yeah, I guess my view is it's unlikely to change, which I think you would probably agree with me on. But I do think there's at least an argument that it might change the incentives of presidents to cater to particular interests over others. And if you believe that having to cater to a diversity of interests sort of spread out geographically is a better constraint on presidents than having to cater to mass media markets where all your ad money is going to be spent, then you might think twice about whether you want to get rid of the Electoral College or not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hope that you will join me.